Hey, folks, before we go ahead and get on into the show, brief reminder, if you like Don't Trust Andrew Main, which is like probably a lot of people because you're listening to this show and Andrew's on it and he has a show on A&E, so you should probably watch that too. It airs on Mondays, so go ahead and watch it. I mean, like, don't make a federal case about it. Secondarily, if you really want to support Andrew, or you just want more information on that awesome show he's on A&E, again, it's called Don't Trust Andrew Main, and it premieres 10 p.m. on Mondays, you can go to facebook.com/Don't Trust Andrew Main. Go ahead and like it. Like it up. Like it till you can't like it anymore, which is really just once, so it's not going to take all that long. But you get all the information on the Facebooks, and that's a good time. Now, I know some of you are saying, but Brian Brushwood and Tom Merritt convinced me to cut the cord. You can get them on iTunes, and you can get them on Amazon, too. Anyhow, let's start the show. Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? We're here to get weird.
Also getting weird, Mr. Brian Brushwood.
That's why I talk in this cadence that's just like Justin Robert Young's.
Well, guys, glad we can all talk in our own radio voices.
And you'll find out what that's about after the break.
Traffic
and
weather together on the fives.
Now, there is a story that's been making the rounds that we have to talk about. Because I saw this. I'm like, this is weird things. Totally us. All right? Now, but first, I'm going to ask you gentlemen a totally unrelated question. You both look kind of tired.
Yeah. That's just because we were up late.
Yeah. You guys look like you've been working hard.
That's one way to put
working.
It. He's the cut up around the office here. Look at his mug. It says, I'm an asshole.
So, anyhow, I can tell by...
Oh my God, this is amazing. It does say I'm an asshole.
This coffee mug for our audio listeners is basically Pulp Fiction, but the faces are two faces you might recognize from elsewhere. Brian Brushwood and Justin Robert.
No. That's not Brian. That's Ashley, my girlfriend.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Okay.
Like I said,
because I was about to say the version I hadn't seen. Ed, that's amazing, dude.
Very quick look, but there is a similarity there. We won't get into that. I think you guys need a vacation. Do you guys want a vacation?
Oh my God, do I ever? I've been sick for a month.
So, yeah, I've got the perfect vacation for you. Okay. Now it's a very, very exclusive vacation. It's something that really only the elite of the elite get to go on.
All right.
Okay. I mean, it's very special, very exclusive. And you're talking. I mean,
is it something that's going to break the bank? Like, do I got to start saving my shiny pennies here?
No, this is going to be all expenses paid, guys.
Oh,
all
sweet. It's good. Is it quiet? I just want to get away from it all. I want to feel.
Oh, it's quiet. And the thing is, it's kind of a secretive kind of thing because we don't really. People get jealous if they find out, and particularly in this day and age where it's like, oh, the 1% and all this. This is like for, you know, the 1% of the 1% of the 1%.
Just tell me it's better than Panama because it took all of 25 seconds before they found Bieber down there.
Yeah. I mean, no, this is actually kind of a tour. It's sort of a world tour kind of thing you get to go on, but like a luxury, a lap of luxury.
Oh, wow. So this is a mobile vacation? Like, is this something that we're going to go to different places, like a cruise?
Yep, very much.
Somebody going to badger me to get my hair braided?
I mean, you could, but, you know, we don't have to go. I mean, maybe this isn't
one of those things where it's like, you know, it's all free, but then it's like you have this obligation to sit through some chattering, you know, like sign up for our thing, is it?
No, it's kind of more of a reward because, you know, you've been deemed special, but like you guys Ooh. Are really, you guys, You're special. You deserve all right, this. But like, don't go telling everybody about it.
Who's deeming us special?
And also, do we qualify?
You'd be deemed special. Well,
come on, shut up, Brian. They're deeming us special here. You want to ruin it?
No, fair enough.
I'll give you an example, an analogy, okay? I want you to imagine you're sitting there and you get a phone call, bring, bring, and you're like, hello? Like, hi, yeah, I work for the president, President Barack Obama. And he's a big fan of what you guys have been doing. I think you guys are doing great work, absolutely great work. And, you know, once thinks you guys could have a vacation, like a fun vacation. And this is not like an analogy. This is not some sort of, hey, we're going to rendition you. I just want you to understand
this isn't like you're selling us and, you know, all of a sudden it's Brian and Justin escape from Guantanamo Bay. Like,
no,
this
not
is
at
a
all.
True.
Literally, it's like, because like he's like, hey, listen, you know, I've got Camp David. I've got some other properties. I've got yachts. I've got stuff. You guys, go on my yacht. Let's go on my yacht. I want you guys to go out there and just enjoy. It's a thing I do for my special friends.
All right. First of all, this all sounds great. Is there any obligation of labor on our part? Like, is there anything, we have to clean anything?
Yes, there is a labor. You're going to have to raise your pina colada to your mouth and sip it yourself.
This sounds great, man. I'm in. Sign me up.
I officially declare this to have no drawbacks, and there's no way that I would ever regret going on this vacation. Sign me up. Without hesitation.
In fact, we've already signed on the dotted line. Explain to us where to take our bags.
So, I'll give you a little bit more of a. You're gonna go on. This is a. It's gonna be a tour on a ship. This ship is. It's quite special. You know, it's a yacht, big large yacht. It's like 300 feet long. It's a luxury ship. It was named for a famous actress. It was, you know, put into use to just entertain the celebrities and the real elites of the Soviet Empire. So it didn't get a whole lot of public attention because he didn't want to, like, point out, like, hey, yeah, no, the people we really like, they get to go on these special cruises while you guys are waiting in line for, you know, bread bags to put on your feet as shoes.
All right. So, well, is so far I'm okay with it. I understand ships have storied history.
Hey, listen, I understand the struggle that the working man is going through, but also I feel like they don't understand my struggle.
No, they don't.
About how much I do for the Soviet culture, and I feel like I need to be rewarded for that.
Here's the thing, and it's not a catch. I promise you, it's not a catch. It's just a reality.
All right.
It is 2014 and the Soviet Empire has sort of fallen.
Yeah, I mean, but the boat floats though, right?
The boat floats. The boat's still there. The boat's got plenty of room for you.
Great.
All right. Well, to be honest, listen. Remember 20 seconds ago when I was talking about how I feel like I should be rewarded by the Soviet Empire? I didn't feel comfortable saying that. I don't support communism or the Soviet Empire. That was really my one drawback on this whole thing. And now that that's eliminated, I feel like it's all gravy train, baby. Woo-woo!
So here's the thing. When you hear, like, you know, sometimes we throw terms around and they're just so loaded, like ghost ship.
Okay? Well, ghost
no
ship?
Ghosts.
No,
it's
okay.
It's just a ship.
Yeah. Well, it's a ship with nobody on it, right?
Nobody on it, yes.
So wait, did people die on this thing?
I'm sure at some point. So, you know,
I mean,
since the
cruise
fall
ship.
Of the Soviet Empire, certain things have been in disarray and the ship sort of, it fell into, like, you know, different hands, and it ended up in Canada. It was chartered for, like, Antarctic cruises and stuff, and then basically it had some accidents and stuff, ran aground, and eventually became too much of a problem to try to fix or do anything. But, it, like, the hull was still good, but it ended up, you know, in Canada. And the owners, I guess they kind of abandoned it, and then it was actually towed to the Dominican to be scrapped, and then it drifted towards Canada, and then the Canadians decided to sort of, they didn't want to handle this, so they sort of just towed it out to sea.
And abandoned it?
Yeah.
Wait, is that a thing that they do with boats?
Apparently it is.
Well, I mean, if you're going to tow it out like to the middle of nowhere international waters, why are you even just leaving it afloat where it might run into something else? Like just poke a hole
not
in it
our
and let
problem,
it go down.
Man.
Wow, that's crazy.
Take it up with the union.
So the boat went adrift off at sea into the horizon and wasn't seen, but then there have been some perhaps some sightings and people thought maybe it sank, but now it's believed that this thing may be sailing towards the coast of England. And well, right. There's oh, go ahead.
I feel like, Andrew, all I'm hearing right now, listen, man, I got bargain ears. And all I can hear is free boat. Free,
yeah, man.
Massive, awesome boat. Me and Brian, we're going to go. We're going to charter a helicopter to take us out to that boat. It's going to be our own little fixer-upper project.
So it seems
we're
like
gonna, we're going to return it back to absolute glory.
So here's the thing. So like the last sighting, actually Ireland said they reported hearing the emergency positioning indicating radio beacon, which could be turned on by water. You know, it could just flip on. So maybe it's headed towards Ireland. So we've got a place to look. There is, you know, so the story came out and had a very sensational headline. And then somebody else said, no, that's not true. It's bunk. And I'm like, what? There's no ghost ship. This isn't true. And then they tried to nitpick one detail of it, which I don't think they successfully nitpicked it because it makes absolute sense to me. Here's the, I don't want to use the word hitch. Here's the reality. Yeah. So you have a ship, you take all the people off the ship. What's left?
Well, you take off the people, you got equipment, you got
equipment,
you
supplies,
you got rats,
supplies.
You got foods.
Well, yeah, you do have the rats.
Oh, so okay.
You have
a little rat here and there, throw a little rat trap on the ground.
Is that maybe, you know, after they've kind of eaten all the crumbs, there's not a lot left for them to eat except
each other. Well, or fish. Maybe they're catching fish. It could
probably
be a little society.
Fish, Brian. Evolution doesn't seem to work that fast in this case.
I watched The Secret of Nim. I'd like to think that it's populated by a merry band of rat
I'm
pirates.
I'm not gonna argue with you on that. I think that's a much better version of reality than perhaps the idea of the rats been feeding off each other and becoming super cannibal rats.
Oh, man.
That's
either
a lot
one, either one makes
the
a
rescuers
great movie.
Or the rescuers down under.
It's like the rescuers turned like Logan's Run or something, where it's just like all of a sudden it's like you're allowed to live until a certain age when, you know, your paw beeps and turns red and then you have to go into the pit where you fight for your life and then everyone eats you. I'm okay with that movie too.
So, all right. So when we say cannibal rats, do we mean that they are eating each other or that if they were to, say, run aground in merry old Ireland, they would then stream out into the streets and start eating people?
Well, then they would be predatory rats, right?
Those two ideas are not mutually exclusive. So you may have a super breed of cannibal rats in a ghost ship about to run aground somewhere in Europe and run free. Eating and pillaging their way across the continent. It's probably how the Dark Ages started.
That's was with a boat of super cannibal zombie
rats. Oh, my God.
Rats.
Actually, it's really funny that we're talking about this. This just came in over my phone. France has already surrendered. France has surrendered to the cannibal rats. They've just preemptively said, all right, listen, just that's
France,
fine.
Big you fans of the it. Weird Things podcast. Who knew? Who knew?
Yeah.
So I just the idea, it's I just think that we live in a world right now where there's a very serious possibility there's a Soviet ghost ship roaming the Atlantic filled with rats waiting to run aground somewhere.
How long could that theoretically last, though? Like, if you're going to do the, I mean, like if they're eating each other, at some point there has to be one king rat who dies of old age, right? I guess they're breeding faster, I guess, than they can eat each other.
Man,
well, it could be like there could be cockroaches and other things to feed off of, and it depends upon what extra food is entering the ecosystem. What animals inside of there can do things like eat the furniture or eat?
You
got to
figure like sooner or later. There's I don't know how tall the boat is, but you could see a scenario where like you know a fish flops up and then dies on the deck or whatever, like that kind of thing.
Maybe, but it could be mold. It could be seagull poo. There could be a lot of other things. So I think it's somebody's gonna have a fascinating thesis.
But it's got to wind down to zero, right? I mean, there's not enough to sustain.
No, you could have mold. You could have other things. Like
just
if you
forever?
Have other you have insects and stuff that can eat off of that.
Wow. You just kind of blew my mind because I thought for sure it's like locking it in a terrarium and sooner or later it runs out. But I guess there's still energy coming in and you got sunlight and so something could grow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Maybe.
And so now this is, so this could be, let's say the boat kind of comes up to Europe and Europe's like, sorry, woo, and like pushes them back out to sea.
This is all of Europe takes their giant sandaled foot and just sort of kicks the ghost boat back and out to sea.
Puts it back out. Like they could, this rat kingdom, this cannibal rat kingdom could live forever.
I mean, that's what I'm being told.
Infinite cannibal rat kingdom.
Oh, man.
Where, I mean, and like, talk about the evolution of just those rats, right? I mean, like, when you talk about super aggressive or you know, like, they would definitely behaviorally just be different than your average kind of, you know, New York City sewer rat, right?
Yeah. Oh, no. They would eat them for breakfast. Like, literally. They'd be all like, look, a gift from New York. It's a genuine New York sewer rat. Nom, 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 nom.
You know, they don't make them like they do in New York. It's just better.
It's like, look how fat and well-fed this thing is. Hasn't seen the light of day even once. That's why they make them good.
So,
New York sewer rats are the veal of cannibal rats.
Yes.
I kind of mainly mean more me, and I'll put it all on me. We got a request back in, we'll just call it 2013.
Sure. For lack of a better term for that year.
And what it was is we were asked to send out a birthday shout out that would serve as a Christmas present for a fan of the show.
Man, I'm trying to figure out how this went bad. Like that fan was,
yep.
Was John Wayne Gacy.
Email chain, and I see that we got an email around, I don't know, November 27th, so 2 months ago. And I think we're like, yeah, sure. We ended up not doing a Christmas podcast, and then we forgot, by we, I mean me, forgot to do a follow-up and do this. And now I'm going through the email here, and I don't actually see the name of the person we're supposed to be doing the shout-out to. I have his son's first name and the last name, so I assume, and this is, he wanted it to his father. So I can only assume the father probably shares the same last name.
So Mr. would be his first name.
Yes.
So happy birthday, Mr.
Hall.
Mr. Paul?
Hall.
Hall. Okay, what's funny is I would love it if it turns out it's from Rand Paul to his father, Ron. But Hall, Mr. Hall, happy birthday.
Mr. Hall.
Happy birthday, Hall.
Your son, Kevin, is a great son. He asked for this way, way in advance, even prior to Black Monday and all that. And there he was, Christmas Day, waiting to unwrap this joy for you.
And we failed
to deliver.
Yeah.
Your son is not the flake that you think he is, even though he probably stays up late listening to weird things. And
your host, however.
NSFW show and, you know, kind of the people he watches and stuff online are a little bit degenerate. That's really nothing else to call it, guys. Let's be honest.
Mondays, 10 p.m. on A&E.
Yeah. So this is for you, Mr. Hall.
This moment of silence.
Yeah, I felt really kind of awkward. So anyhow, we apologize, Kevin. Sorry. And you know what? Christmas is just around the corner.
Oh, next Christmas already.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Hall.
Merry Christmas.
Killed those two with one.
Man, I feel like we're killing it. I feel like we got it all covered.
Tell you what,
I don't do Christmas cards for a variety of reasons. Mainly because I'm a flake. Gentlemen,
yeah,
shut your mouth talking what? Here. This is okay. All right, I'm gonna take a deep breath here.
You okay? You don't normally get this wound up. You normally keep it together.
We've got a Bigfoot sighting.
Whoa!
All right.
Bigfoot, maybe kind of a jerk. Just saying. So we had some reports of vandalism in Michigan.
By Bigfoot.
Yes. He's been wandering around a Michigan property for more than a decade, shape-shifting and eating pizza.
Oh, my God. All right, what is he shapeshifting into?
Like, and here's my challenge to you, skeptics. At what point did you stop believing, the shapeshifting or the eating pizza?
I'm still believing everything.
Yeah, no, I'm all into it. Listen.
I want to know how eating pizza became the significant detail in this. Tell me more.
On a Saturday, and this is a couple weeks ago, I'm sorry for getting so long to get this to you. A 52-year-old Breckenridge, Michigan man came to the Midland Law Enforcement Center armed with evidence, including photo albums, empty food containers, dirt, and alleged, wait for it, Bigfoot scat. And I don't think they meant like a Mel Torme-style album.
No.
Ask for help verifying the existence of the mythical
He's like, maybe this will convince you, and he hits play on a tape recorder.
This is coming to us from the Huffington Post, by the way. The man, Anthony Padilla, spoke to a sheriff's deputy explaining that he accidentally awoke the Bigfoot spirit by knocking branches against trees to break them into smaller pieces. This began when we moved into a 17-acre property in 1997. According to the incident report, which was sent to the Huffington Post.
Okay. So,
I'll get one more, Brian. Okay. One more, all right?
Yeah.
Hold on to your brain.
Okay, I'm doing my best.
Padilla had a serious sighting 7 years ago when he thought he saw a man in a ghillie suit hunting. For our friends on the coast, that's a camouflage suit with lots of foliage attached to it. But when they locked eyes, the being began to fade and turn into a mist. The mist then reformed into a white-tailed deer and ran away into the woods.
Okay.
Here's my favorite part about the. All right, listen. When this guy goes for shape-shifting, he ain't just no nickel and dime, dollar store shape-shifting sighting, right?
Right.
He came in with the transition. It's not just like I saw this thing and then in a blink of an eye, it was another thing. No. He has his own video toaster era, like, you know, fade in, fade out.
Well, keep in mind, he said he first.
That's awesome.
He first awakened him in the late 90s. So this would have been the era it has to speak to the special effects of that time.
Yeah. Happened like a few years earlier, it'd be like the Michael Jackson, you know, face thing, you know.
So,
like cut to the shot of the transformation on the floor.
So, assuming, let's take all this at face value, right? How do you, I guess, the first moment that it occurs to you that something is afoot has to be, when you see the man in the ghillie suit flash in mist and then turn into a white-tailed deer and then run away. How do you crack the code that it's because you broke some sticks a few years back in 1997?
I think this guy is pretty good at putting connections between things that nobody else would ever see.
It's very perceptive, Brian. Very, very perceptive. The things that drop through the cracks for many of us, this guy has a beat on. Also, imagine you're this creature. You know, you are you have shapeshifted into a man in a ghillie suit, right?
Yeah.
Somebody sees you and he's like, "Oh no, I've been spotted in my ghillie suit." White-tailed deer, get the hell out of there. What is so shameful about this man's ghillie suit?
Well, first of all, what's he up to that he needs to be in the form of a man who's wearing camouflage? That's the question. I think that he's up to something. It's not that he's ashamed of being a guy in camouflage. It's that he's probably doing some creeping peeping, good old sass peeping.
I'm gonna throw a hypothetical out at you, okay?
Yeah.
We've talked about it before. The idea that we could all be living in some sort of simulated reality. If you accept the idea of quantum computers and be able to simulate reality, and you could have an infinite number of realities, then the chances are that our one's a real one, is remote, then it's more likely we're in, you know, the Matrix, okay?
Right.
Supposing that was true and there's somebody up on top who gets to pull strings or hop in there, like, you know, we're running on, you know, the Xbox, you know, Infinity 1 billion, whatever, okay? You know, what would be more fun than to take a very rational, sane person like Brian Brushwood's out and back, watering his lawn, and like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to have Brian have a unicorn sighting.
Well, and I mean, you know, like that's totally something I would be like, I don't know if that was ever an add-on for The Sims or not, but it should have been, where it's like you have your Sims doing their happy little life, and then you just totally mess with one of them. Somebody starts off as like a high-priced executive on Wall Street, then you throw him a unicorn once, and he can't help but talk about it, and he's, you know, talking Simlish, and you see a picture of the unicorn. Then you throw him a little like black helicopter action.
Yeah, and have the unicorn do something totally ridiculous too, like, oh, and then it pulled out an accordion and started playing.
I mean, listen, this, to be fair, in academic circles is referred to as the Michigan J. Frog scenario.
Right. Well, and so I wonder if you kept throwing it at him, how soon he gets a podcast and he goes up opposite of Weird Things. And then before you know it, the guy's screaming on the street, proclaiming to be the Messiah because he sees things that nobody else can see.
I've happened to any one of us. We need to have a code word. Like, we need to have like a special safe word that if that happens to us, that we can tell the other one. And then it's like, oh, okay. And it can only be used for like real paranormal genre bending. Like, guys, like, you know, I saw Jesus last night in my room and he was eating Cheetos.
Okay.
You want to know what I think the biggest change to this podcast is? Seriously, if that happened to one of us, is absolutely nothing. There would be no change. We would have these exact same conversations, except one of us would be like, no, wait, so this happened. Wasn't it awesome? Yes, it was awesome.
And it followed by like, no, guys, I'm serious. Like, that would become the new name of the show, is no, guys, I'm serious.
This is the change for me. I would be here with my hood down like this, like, yeah, okay, all right, guys. No, that's cool. It's all right, next topic.
Next thing we know, you're wearing sunglasses, you got face paint on.
Yeah, sure, whatever. No, and I don't think I'd tell anybody. I would keep this horrible secret to myself out of fear of embarrassment.
So what would be, let's say we saw somebody shapeshift into a white-tailed deer.
All right, let's say it happened to all three of us.
Separately or together?
All three of us together.
Okay.
And I would.
So number one, just as the preface, there's the Three Stooges-esque scenario of the three of us in the woods with all of our like crazy hunting gear.
Yeah,
we're traipsing around.
Let's say we're looking for like a rare species of badger that we hear about, because that's something like plausibly we'd be like, no, this
is it rabid?
Yeah, sure. It's got like an orange tuft or whatever. We're gonna try to snap pictures of it because we hear it's there, right? And then instead we see a man in a ghillie suit puff a mist and then becomes a white-tailed deer and off he runs. Now, here's the thing. Like, I've had stuff like this happen in my dreams enough that I guess I could say with confidence that my reaction will be to immediately assume that something is wrong with my brain. And then, like, all the way to the tune of, like, I would ask, did you see that? But I'll all of a sudden, like, I would institute, like, a verbal quarantine to not say what it is we saw, because you could pollute other people's memories just by describing what it is. And then you get this like consensus. And over the years, all three of us would, you know, cause that's what happens with like these alien kidnappings, right?
I see three scenarios, Brian. If one of us sees it, the other one's like, oh great. Yeah, sure. Whatever. Okay. Are you going to keep going on with that? If two of us see it, the other one's going to be convinced the other two are trying to put them on.
Yeah.
Like, all right, jerks. Okay, fine. If all three of us see it, we've got a cult and a new religion we can start. I mean, so I will tell you right now, if you guys come to me and say, did you see that? And I'm like, maybe I missed it. I'm going to be like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that was orange. That was bright orange. That was neon orange. That was the brightest orange tuft on a badger I ever saw.
You're like, no, dude, the ghillie suit guy transforming into a white-tailed deer.
Yes, I saw that. Yes. That was amazing, the way he turned into that elk. It was amazing.
So this is actually a good question, because if I'm by myself, my go-to scenario is to assume there's something wrong with my brain and I didn't see it. But does that change if all three of us are convinced we see it? Like, do you believe the others?
I think we try to look for an analysis to find out if there's a reason why we might be sharing this hallucination. Do we have some experience? We look for evidence to imply that we try to disprove it.
Yeah.
And we talked a bit about this before in our Bigfoot rape scenario, which apparently now is a big form of genre fiction.
Oh, yeah.
So
cottage industry for Bigfoot erotica.
Yeah, fans of that. I think we have an episode called Touched by Bigfoot or something. And, you know, a similar situation. We go camping and one of us has a horrific sexual encounter, unwanting, with Bigfoot, and then has to deal with the shame and trauma of trying to tell the others.
Listen, all I know is that we see that ghillie suit man turn into the white-tailed deer, then I'm spending the rest of my life with white-tailed deer on the brain, and I'm doing the three T's, tracking, tagging, and tickling them. I'm going to find out which one's the man in the ghillie suit if it's the last breath I take.
Wow.
All right. Gentlemen.
I'd like to think that that could be in season four of Don't Trust Andrew Maine. Like he's the lead in to tag ticklers, where it's like trapping, tagging, and tickling them.
Well, I was like, when you watch like To Catch a Predator, of which we steal a lot of our camera technique from, what kills me is like you'd see the guy go out the front door and some police departments, you get some cop in the ghillie suit like hiding in the bushes.
Yeah.
Oh, like, God. Yeah.
Do you really need that? No. It was just like, I know it'll be cool. I'm going to put on a ghillie suit and hide in a front yard. You know, yeah. You see the guy come running out.
No. Yeah. It would always, they'd always like add like a flourish with each season. Like by like the sixth, that somebody was like parasailing in, you know, to come tackle the guy as he was running out.
They get the fan man to come in with a giant thing that says, sorry, you're a pedophile.
It was like with the ghillie suit, it's like, hey, look, Swamp Thing's making the arrest.
Yeah.
All right. I figure for the last act of this podcast, we could talk about a movie now that I've seen it. We've all three seen Gravity, right?
Yes. I felt it.
Well, do we want to? All right, here. Let me propose something. Do we want to do picks and then we'll do Gravity?
Sure.
And so that way people could cut it off if they want to save it.
All right.
Yep. All right. Yeah, I'm always hesitant to say, oh, don't worry, it's not too spoilery, but what's, you know, one
man. No, we'll end up spoiling the hell out of it, but it's past the statute of limitations.
But it also could be like something that you could say like, oh, that's a spoiler.
That's fine.
For me.
Well, because it's back out in theaters. So
Sandra Bullock's in it.
See it.
What?
What?
It's in space.
So, who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I'll pick another movie. I went to go see Her yesterday.
Oh, dude, I really wanted to see that. And I asked Brant, he said it was good. He said it's so good. I went and saw it again the same next night. And I said, well, I was thinking about seeing something with Bonnie. Is that a good one to take Bonnie to? And he says, ah. And so I haven't seen it yet. That's the only reason.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like it is. I think Bonnie would dig it. It's certainly, you know, you will call it navel gazy if you want to be critical or you know, philosophical if you want to be charitable. It is a long lingering look at like what our interactions are with AI specifically and kind of consumer friendly AI. It's not a story where things go horrifyingly wrong. It's a suffocating tale of this one guy's interaction with his kind of all encompassing artificial intelligence, which is, I think, kind of a Siri. Siri is probably the closest thing that we can get to it to contextualize it. But you very much understand it when you see the movie. If you like Spike Jonze stuff, it's excellent. It's very well shot. It's great to see Joaquin Phoenix acting in a movie where he's not tremendously damaged or like a complete psychopath. And Scarlett Johansson, I think it's kind of a shame that she can't get recognized for acting awards for, you know, basically carrying half the movie without ever seeing her face. So great stuff. Go ahead and see it. Although I will say this, it is no surprise to me that the critical community, which is by and large white guys who live alone, are falling over themselves and talking about how amazing Her is. It is very much speaking to that demographic.
That's awesome.
I have a pick.
Yeah.
It's called Her. It's a movie I just saw. As a white guy living alone, I got to tell you, this movie really, really spoke to me. I'm going to piggyback on Jessica's. That's my pick is going to be Her. I loved the movie. I love Spike Jonze, by the way. And
yeah.
There are people who go see a movie like Lost in Translation or movies of that sort of genre or whatever kind of things that feel a little bit kind of out there and sort of maybe they don't connect. I thoroughly enjoyed this, and I liked this for several reasons. And part of the reason I liked it is I thought it was just a fantastic love story. I thought it was a the way that it just it connected. And the reason I brought up Lost Translation is because that's a movie by Sofia Coppola that's loosely kind of about Spike Jonze.
Right. You know? As a matter of fact, like Spike Jonze, not Spike Jonze, shows up for about 3 minutes, is a total asshole to her, who's too busy with his career and being awesome, and then marches off screen.
There are, if you want to see these two movies, Lost in Translation and Her, as bookends to the divorce of Spike Jonze and Sofia Coppola, I think you would be able to draw, because there is a character in Her which you could fairly credibly see as an allegory to Sofia Coppola, as we watching it from afar might be able to put together. But it's so funny that I thought exactly that.
Yes, it is. It's, I'm watching this going, wow, it's like there's like two. But anyhow, I loved Her, and I tell you, I loved it for a couple of reasons. I thought the acting was fantastic. I thought the design and look of it was amazing, and you know, the clothing, and you look at it and you can read into what you want, but I look forward to hearing Spike Jonze talking about it. But it's like everybody dresses very dorky and like old people. You know, they wear like sans belt pants, and it's kind of like this it reminded me of, like, I don't know, when you kind of give up.
And, oh yeah, and you don't care what you look like anymore.
Yeah, for the shooting, they mixed scenes of LA with Shanghai, which was just fascinating. And there's a great shot when you know Shanghai, you know you're in Shanghai, because you see everybody walking towards you is Western. All the background actors walking away from the camera are Asian.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's kind of funny. But I enjoyed it on that level, a story, acting, and then as a science fiction film. This is really, there is a really good deep, if you're into singularity stuff and all this, this movie does not ignore that. It doesn't just say, hey, here's a cool idea about, you know, a romance between a man and an AI. What would be if we talked to Ray Kurzweil and some other people and say, well, what would happen next? What would happen here? What happened that? And it's the best film, the only film really on the singularity that's ever been done, but I heartily recommend it.
Wow. All right. Well, I'll have to definitely have to check that out. So I don't know if this is a pick so much as just, did you have something more, Justin?
Yeah. The one last thing, and to just kind of fill out more with what Andrew said, there are movies where when you tell a story in the future, you tend to kind of fall into like, you get the box that says like, this is what the future looks like, and let's do all these future things. And this is a story that we can, it's never spelled out, but we are assuming takes place about 10 or 15 or, you know, 20 years in the future or something like that. And it's great. It just the design, the fashion just was awesome.
I'll give you one thing to look for. It's that if you watch the way they do interactions, you never see a keyboard.
Yeah.
There's no keyboards anywhere. And I thought just the conscious decisions they made, the idea was to sort of take, and I'll tell you, this is what I loved about, this is how they made their sort of version of the futures. They said, let's take our reality today and strip away things.
Right.
You know, instead of cluttering it up with blinking lights or things like this and interfaces and stuff. And there's, you know, things that come into play, like, you know, how he plays video games is cool and all. But I just loved the idea that it was not like, let's not throw more gadgets in it. Let's take the things you're familiar with and then strip them away to the bare essence, which I thought was just very, very intelligent.
Well, which is certainly in keeping with the trend that we've seen, you know, over Absolutely. The last 30, 40 years is, you know, UI is getting out of the way to where we interact directly with our simulations and even with our communications. Like, mm-hmm. look at what we're experiencing right now in terms of what we, you know, thought and hoped was possible 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It's my favorite thing that Spike Jonze has done since his cameo in Wolf of Wall Street.
Now I want to know what his cameo in Wolf of Wall Street was.
And I won't tell you.
Okay. All right. Like, will it's I know fun. It's him when he shows up?
Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. If you know what he looks like. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I guess this is a pick. It's certainly what I'm reading, and I'm in the last part of it right now. I'm reading a book called The Charisma Myth that basically is, I don't know, like a psychological breakdown of what it means to be charismatic and what people respond to in charismatic. And charisma is not something that's natural. It's not something that automatically happens. It's something that that people make the decision to behave in a way that other people find charismatic. And you feel kind of gross reading that kind of story or book at first. But then the advice is just extraordinary because you see things from a different perspective that you never thought about. Like the opening thesis of the book, the first chapter is that all charisma, and this is their idea, maybe they're wrong, but it seems to fit. All charisma, to project charisma, you must project presence, which means like the level of engagement, because we've all been there where you're talking to someone and they're glancing off to see if somebody more important is coming in the room or checking their tweets or fiddling or whatever. Presence, power, which is part of why, you know, if you've ever, even as Steve Jobs would be a total asshole, you couldn't deny the fact that he was an extremely powerful individual and that when he would give you his full attention, you found yourself, as they referred to it, like in that, under the spell of Steve Jobs, presence, power, and warmth. And then that's, and when you think of warmth, you just immediately think like Bill Clinton, this ability to really understand and provide, you know, project positive vibes or whatever. And the rest of the book is really about, you know, breaking down with examples, presence, power, and warmth, and how to fix it. If you don't have one of those, let's say you're not powerful, let's say you got a low-end job or whatever, then you can provide a bit of a sense of power by dressing above your station and dressing better. That's part of the reason that we have the trappings of, you know, and even at some level, like I think about what we're doing right now on the Weird Things podcast, you know, little things like this little BB Studios bug in the corner, you know, that is a trapping of power to remind people who are watching that, or at least try to convince people who are watching that we know what we're doing here or whatever. It's fascinating when you step outside yourself and look at what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong, if your goal is to engage with other people effectively. I really, really am enjoying it. And I suspect like a couple of years from now, I'll probably reread it just to refresh myself on everything. But it's called The Charisma Myth, and I'm doing it on Audible.
I just pulled that up on Amazon as you talked about it. I think that sounds fantastic. As performers, we try to think about these things. And then when I have to go in and pitch TV shows, and you're going to be in a room with people who are green light shows, very powerful people, involved in the entertainment industry, who see people all day long, TV stars, et cetera, all that, and going in that room and thinking to yourself, okay, how do I sell myself? How do I go push myself across? And that was a thing that just, I never had this book to go read it, Brian. I had to figure some things out on my own. Well,
and that's just it. Like all of us, you know, we understand things like don't interrupt other people. And there's other things.
I think that.
there's other things like I realized that I was over encouraging people. Like I would say, to keep the conversation going and let people know that I was paying attention. But if you do it just one time too many, it puts people off because it makes them feel like you're not paying attention. And instead you're just goosing things along. Exactly. Right. And so stuff like what's acceptable amounts of eye contact when you're the one talking versus you're the one listening, for example, in negotiations, they'll worry, the people who are handling negotiations will worry a lot about what kind of room they're walking into and how the seats are arranged, because they know that if they're sitting, studies show that if you sit face to face again with someone, that they're less likely to really hear what you're saying. They're likely to adopt a more defensive posture, and that you're statistically less likely to get what you want out of it. So they'll make sure to sit either at a 90-degree angle or ideally both on the same side, because these things matter physiologically. It's fascinating. It's all these little tidbits like that.
Yeah. One of the things that I do, like if I go into a room or a meeting, I pay attention to everybody around me, and the person who makes the comment that maybe didn't get heard by everybody else, I'll address them and I'll make like, oh, what was that? And do that and try to be, as you talk about presence, to be the most present person in the room. And sometimes rather than they ignored it, I'm going to ignore it. But like, no, pull them into it. Because what happens if I'm the guy like, oh yeah, you become sort of the switcher. You become the person that's saying, well, what did they say? What did they say? So people will watch where your attention goes. And that can, you know, pull that into. I mean, that, there's a lot of little things like that, but it's being kind to that person, like the quiet person, the other person in the room. But
well, that's the warmth, right? I mean, it's like you establish power by being the one directing the conversation. And then this is a salesman strategy, is the person asking the question is the one who's in charge of the conversation. And so by establishing kind of not that you have to dominate over someone else, but that you put yourself in a position of power, you show warmth by directing attention to somebody who has a good idea that maybe didn't get heard, and you certainly show that you're 100% present on all of that.
Yeah, and it can be somebody, they make a little joke or they make something like that, and nobody else heard it, but looking over them, give them the smile or whatever, let you know. because it then makes them feel better. And then overall, you know,
one of the things that one of the studies mentioned in here, they talk about the general idea that establishing eye contact will have a very potent effect on people, and to try to cause it to happen without anyone knowing it, they would take a male and female university students, and they would give them the task of, you know, watch the other person very intently and count how many times they blink. So this is their job, right? And it would be for like an hour or 15 minutes, who cares, whatever amount of time. But just in the fact that they had an excuse to stare intently into each other's eyes, even though it ostensibly had nothing to do with it, you know, they would report feelings of a deep connection, or in some cases, it really was that whole love at first sight thing where people were like all of a sudden crazy about each other because they felt like they understood each other, because that's such a powerful cue, you know, biologically, all the way in the back of our reptile brains.
On the subject of eye contact, when I went in over a year ago to go pitch with my partners the show Don't Trust Andy Remain to A&E, well, not called that then. That was A&E's title. half the people, the decision makers, were going to be on video conference, because we did this in LA and A&E headquarters is in New York. And so there's a big video screen, and the tendency is to look up at the screen, but the camera was below the screen. And so I tried to make a conscious effort when I talked to the people there was to look at the camera, so the people 2,000 miles away sitting in a conference room saw me looking at them and not looking there.
Right.
You know, and it can make, and it's a subtle thing, but it's that, you know, this is trying to sell a TV show. TV is the medium, and trying to make sure that I can connect through there, as opposed to like here, like my eyes are gravitating towards, you know, your faces. Well, to be honest, my face on the Skype screen.
Which is interesting, because like on the Skype, for those of you guys watching us live on the video layout, I usually favor setting myself on the left and using a camera that makes it look, even though I'm looking at the screen, to the viewer at home. I guess the reason I'm attracted to this view is because it looks like I'm looking at the other guests. Even though I'm looking at, you know, whatever, you know, running the show stuff usually. So I don't know how that factors in. I at least want to look like I'm attentive to you guys.
Thank you, Brian.
I think it comes through.
Gentlemen, now we've come to the close of that part of the show and the final act. If you've not seen Gravity, you might want to tune out. Not a lot of spoilery stuff, but I say that, but then we could spoil something and ruin it for you.
Yeah.
I'm going to say we most certainly are going to spoil it, because I personally am definitely going to talk about parts that will spoil it.
Well, and also it's a hard thing to even gauge spoilers on, because it's like it's a fairly simple story.
Spoiler alert. Done.
Yeah. Spoiler alert.
There.
Spoiler.
So the fact that she dies, I thought was tragic. I didn't think I needed it in that way.
Well, which, I mean, if you want to go out of order, that is, and I told this to Andrew last night, it was one of those rare moments where I went into a movie fully convinced. Like when I saw the advertisements and knowing what little I know about space, when a person gets flung out into the black void of space with nothing but a spacesuit on, clearly it's not good. Yes, yeah. So yeah. I think to myself, clearly this is going to be a one-act play about two souls that are drifting farther and farther apart until they die and freeze to death, you know? And I was excited just for it to be that. But instead, what it was turned out to be so much more. And as you get to the third act, and it occurs to me, oh my God, I think there's a chance they might actually make it. And then it is like, what, is that possible? And then when you get to the dramatic, most dramatic moment of the movie, I honestly didn't know whether or not it would happen. And I would have been fine either way. And that very rarely happens for me at the movies. And I enjoyed that aspect a lot.
So, you know, going into it, I knew what we had from the trailers. And then I heard, you know, oh, Neil deGrasse Tyson has this epic rant about the scientific inaccuracies in it. And, you know, reported it really, you know, popular science, Neil deGrasse Tyson's awesome Twitter rant about science errors and gravity. And I had some of my science-minded friends like, yeah, some of the science errors or whatever. And like, I'm like, listen, I love science. I'm not a scientist. I admit that freely. I'm a storyteller. I'm a guy that I will sometimes watch movies and pick up on like, oh, that doesn't seem to make sense, or I don't think they needed to do that, whatever, some sense of that. But I'm also aware of the fact that smart people like to assert how smart they are by pointing out, well, yeah, that was good, except for the errors here or whatever. It's like this weird passive-aggressive nerd tendency to sort of be like, yeah, it's smart, but I'm smarter because I can tell you where they got it wrong, you know?
Right.
I'm guilty of that. I've done that. I admit that, okay? So I waited to read any of the scientific inaccuracies, whatever, because I wanted to see how did I, a reasonably intelligent guy, you know, was I in the movie going, you know, but I don't do that in movies.
So you protected yourself. You did not know what any of the complaints Neil deGrasse Tyson was going
to
have.
Which and also just to catch everybody up on what this whole Neil deGrasse Tyson thing is. So he, I think in the week or 2 weeks into the movie being out, it being in wide release, he went on a big Twitter thing that was probably, Andrew, you have it in front of you, but I think it was like 7 or 9, you know, different tweets about like, you know, like that were just kind of like moments from the movie that he felt were scientific inaccuracies. Now, that went on. It kind of became its own tempest in a teapot, as things on Twitter tend to do. Some people were like, yeah, that's great. Gravity's a movie. Movies aren't science. And then other people were like, just, you know, sit on a potsy. It's a movie. And it was really good. And eventually, a couple hours later,
5 hours later,
and I think after significant kind of backlash, he was like, no, 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 you guys misunderstood me. I love the movie. I just, science.
Which, if you read his tweets, that's not quite evident because a lot of them weren't about the science. And again, Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's bringing back cosmos. This guy's a fantastic popularizer of science, et cetera. I'm a big, big fan. A big
fan,
but I love movies.
Tends to get a little beat up on this show.
Yeah, does, but again, we love
him. That's fine. We love him. And he's smarter than all of us.
But I love movies, too. And so I'm going to go through some of his tweets here. And I'm going to tell you, I watched the movie and I said, man, this is a little bit kind of maybe pushing it as far as I understand it. And maybe this is pushing it too a little bit. But nothing to me. I said, oh, no, that's egregious.
Are we going through in order? Because I'll be happy to play the part of Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And again, I'm not a rocket scientist. I'm a guy on a reality TV show. So bear that in mind. So then I went, and Brian's going to go through these. I looked at each one by one and go, well, no, there's this. If I was going to be, anyhow, go ahead, Brian, and let's take these apart as a group and see.
All right, here we go. And I'm gonna try to throw the them on screen as well. Gravity. There we go. Okay. First off, Neil deGrasse Tyson's awesome Twitter rant about science errors in Gravity. We present to you the virtual discussion between host of Cosmos and the host of Don't Trust Andrew Vane. Take it away, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Go ahead, Justin.
The film Gravity should be renamed Zero Gravity.
It's an opinion.
The film Gravity should be renamed Angular Momentum.
Why they didn't jump on that name, I have no idea.
Wait, maybe you could explain more, Neil deGrasse Tyson, just to make it clear for us?
I think I will. FYI, angular momentum, the tendency, once set in rotating, to keep rotating unless another force acts to slow or stop it.
Does that do anything to change your position, Mr. Main?
False. That is not. Of course that's true. Yeah.
All right. Mr. Tyson, the floor is yours.
Gravity depicts a scenario of catastrophic satellite destruction that can actually happen.
Do you have a problem with that, Mr. Main?
I agree. It could happen. I was not aware of how much of a big scenario that was until the movie Gravity came out.
All right.
Mysteries of Gravity. Why Bullock, a medical doctor, is servicing the Hubble telescope?
Aha! This is a scientific inaccuracy and not harping on the movie writing.
Yeah, that's one, that's not an impossibility. But two points of fact would be interesting. One, in the story, they explain that she has experience with medical imaging. That's that they're installing this new motherboard into the telescope. This is a medical imaging unit that she has experience with. It's not uncommon for people who are multidisciplinaries. I know people who are medical doctors, who are also biologists, et cetera. But more to the point, if you remember the original Hubble repair mission, if you're old enough to remember that was they were upgrading, they're fixing the Hubble. What was going wrong with it?
Yeah, well, because in the when they initially put up the Hubble, somebody did inches instead of centimeters, right?
Yeah, something like that. One of the astronauts, one of the people who was servicing the Hubble, actually out there on the end of the pole, modifying it, making changes, is Mr. Story Musgrave, an American hero, astronaut. He has been on several shuttle missions. Also, a physician.
What? Wait a minute.
He's
so you're
medical
saying
medical doctor?
You're saying that we actually had a medical doctor?
We had a
service?
Physician fixing the Hubble.
Touche. Mr. deGrasse Tyson, is there anything you want to respond there? Uh-oh.
Is Brian?
Oh, let me hear it. I wasn't going to put the next tweet on. I just wanted you to have an argument as Neil deGrasse Tyson.
I'm not doing an impression of Neil deGrasse Tyson. Okay. Mysteries of gravity. How Hubble, 350 miles up, ISS, 230 miles up, and a Chinese space station are all in sight lines of one another.
Poor planning.
Well, and this is something we talked about last night because that's right. They're all in fact, the Hubble is in such a high orbit that there was a while that NASA announced, yeah, we're not going to service Hubble anymore. It's too dangerous to go that high.
This is an alternate universe where we have a shuttle program still. And we decided that, you know, George Clooney and Sandra Bullock changed their names and became astronauts. Yeah. It is both of those are in low Earth orbit. It is entirely possible that both of these, their version of Hubble, their version of the Chinese satellites, whatever, you know, could end up changing their orbits using altitude adjustments and end up in a level path, which would, yeah, not be the smartest thing to do to put them in that sort of level, whatever. It's not a scientific impossibility. It is not accurate to our world, but neither is the fact that this happened. This did not happen. And so they've created a scenario in which this could happen, and that scenario doesn't violate the laws of physics at all.
I mean, that's the part that I don't know why I didn't think about that. The fact that it took you to point out like, it's not the real planet Earth. You could tell because this never happened. This is an alternate reality. And as long as you're writing in alternate realities, why not write them all in the same orbit?
Yeah, and we don't have to rewrite the laws of physics to make that part of the story make true. I mean, again, it would be kind of a dumb idea to put them in that thing, but maybe what we missed was 6 months earlier, we tried to do, you know, there was another mission that actually put, you know, better, you know, control jets on the Hubble that allowed it to, you know, change orbit at will. And that these are things that could be true. They could be true. So I don't have a problem.
And like by the nature of this story, it is a hour and a half, a super tight story of how somebody could theoretically survive in the harshest of all possible conditions, the expanses of space alone. You know, so it's like, yes, has the story kind of slid these tiles a little closer together so we can actually have survive? Yeah. But, you know, I don't know. They made for a good movie.
Yeah, and it's a thing that's done all the time in, you know, movies that are... I watched Captain Phillips, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed Captain Phillips. Captain Phillips, I'm not going to say it's scientifically inaccurate because they took things that did not happen and put them next to each other for the economy of the storytelling. You know, the pirates didn't show up right after they do a drill for pirates. Captain, 2 days later, doesn't matter. You know, it was not trying to, they didn't have to change the laws of science, whatever. And gravity so far to me hasn't done it. Again, not a rocket scientist, could be mistaken on that, but.
Mr. deGrasse Tyson.
Mysteries of gravity. When Clooney releases Bullock's tether, he drifts away. In zero G, a single tug brings them together.
Okay. Let's talk about this. And this is one of the things a lot of science nerds are like, yeah, it's like it pops out. It's cringeworthy. Let's address this for a moment. So Clooney is attached to the end of the tether. Bullock is being held on loosely by this parachute strap that's over part of the station. And he's being pulled away. There's a subtle, you know, the force, he's still feeling inertia trying to pull them away. And they're sliding. They still have a force active and they're sliding slowly.
Right.
There's also, again, it is very minor, but there actually is the problem they have is there is atmospheric drag, very, very slight, but there is atmospheric drag. That's one of the reasons why the International Space Station actually changes the pitch of its solar panels during its orbit, because if it's flat out, it gets dragged. There is a very, very slight amount of drag, but the most important factor is, if we go back to Newton, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. If they tug, if Clooney tugs on the tether, or she tugs on the tether, she is going to be tugging on the straps that are tenuously holding her to the space station.
Right.
Now, you can also say, hey, psychologically, in their mind, you know, they're not in the most rational place, but also the idea that if he pulls on her, she pulls on him, and they pull that force, there's going to be a pull away from the station. Will it bring them to the station, or will it cause the parachute to slip free and for her to escape? Now, we could argue that 999 times out of 1,000, it'll be fine. They would go towards that. Clooney's goal is to give her the single best chance of surviving. He's watching this ink strip away. One extra pound of force, maybe all it takes to lose that. Would she drift towards the space station? Would she get caught up in the parachute and wrapped up in there? Did not bother me. I thought about it in theater. I thought about this, and I thought about, well, what would happen? I said, well, if he pulled on her, yeah, he would have a little bit of a tug forward. But if it lost the connection to the parachute, or that slipped free or ripped or whatever, you know, they'd have to drift towards there.
Here's the funny part. Like, if as far as the movie goes, what matters is not whether or not Clooney was right in his supposition. What matters is, did he believe that was the case, yeah, right? And as long as he believed that if he held on, he was going to screw her chances over, then it makes sense that, I mean, the guy could be wrong. He could have been totally wrong. And in which case, you know, the ghost of Neil deGrasse Tyson could hover over him saying, like, you didn't need to do that. You died for nothing. But as far as making a good and consistent movie, there's nothing about this that even remotely touches
it. Yeah,
that.
I didn't want, like, the whole, the physics thing was like, well, they would talk, again, the thing was coming loose. It wasn't they had a hard fasten to it. It was kept slipping and slipping. Let's play physics advocate here. If she pulls on him, there's a force being applied to those straps. They could come free. Granted, theoretically, maybe they would drift right back towards the space station, but they could drift free in space entirely.
Okay. Not to mention, to change that fact would ruin what I consider to be the funniest of gravity that we have heard from Amy Poehler and Tina Fey, that Gravity, the movie that proves that George Clooney would rather float out into space and die than spend one night with a woman his own age.
Nicely done. All right, look, let's get back to hard science here.
All right.
Mr. Yeah. deGrasse Tyson.
Mysteries of gravity. Why anyone is impressed with a zero-G film 45 years after being impressed with 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Okay. This is the guy 5 hours later is like, no, I loved the film.
Okay. Yeah. That's all.
2001 Space Odyssey, fantastic film. The way they shot it, you know, it's Kubrick's state of the art. You know, they went into like a grain silo in the middle of the United Kingdom. They suspended people upside down over the camera. The cameras looked up. They had projectors projecting on the glass, projecting stars in back of them. It was an amazing technical achievement. When Lucas was doing Star Wars, he's like, I hope I can make it look as good as, you know, this movie that came out almost 10 years before because it was so state of the art.
Right.
Guess what? Moving forward, when I was watching Gravity, there were things there that I'm going like, I know how you can do the shot. I don't know how they did the shot. And that looks amazing to me.
Yeah, agreed. Also, 2001 is an important movie. I don't know how great it is. I mean,
And that gets into the whole, like, yeah, you know, why is anybody impressed? And that the idea of hating somebody else's joy. And like, we've talked about this before. There are movies that, like, I don't like as much as other people, but I will not try to talk you into not liking it. I might say, this is all the problems I have with it, but I never wanted to come out of the conversation as somebody going, you know what? You're right. I should hate this.
Right.
Well, it's like the reasons why 2001 and Gravity are great movies. I mean, beyond being both of them being technical achievements in terms of how you shoot movies, which I think we note, but I don't know how much that really drives box office attention, are the stories, you know, that they both had compelling stories and good acting performances to hang them on. And they were engrossing works, you know, both for their era and going forward. Like, would Gravity be what it is if the story wasn't, you know, as economically well told and as kind of engrossing as it was? I don't think so.
I talked about this with Brian on the phones, like there are, and Justin, there are things that Curran did in Gravity that drove me a little bit nuts from just a storytelling point of view that were just sort of ham-fisted to me. But it was an amazing movie. I mean, it was, to use a Brianism, you know, that cheapened you. But still love the movie.
Yeah, sure, sure. And by the way, for anyone who's bristling because I said 2001 may not be a great movie, 2001 is an important movie, but 2010 is a better movie from beginning to end, and it gets totally underrated, especially if you remember the Cold War in those times. You
don't think so? Not even going to weigh in on this.
What, oh, really? You disagree?
Not even going to weigh in on this.
You are going to weigh in on this? Or
I'm not. No. Oh, okay. Back to
All
Gravity.
Right, fine. All right. Mr. DeGrasse Tyson.
See, I think once again, Brian, you should own it. You're like, hey, listen, if you have a problem with me, this is on 2001, come get some.
Yeah. All right. Fine. Eat crap, jerks. Mr. DeGrasse Tyson.
Mysteries of Gravity. Why Bullock's hair in otherwise convincing zero-G scenes did not float freely on her head?
Didn't she have, like, pins in it or something?
The answer is Aquanet.
Done.
We've got it. We've got a hair gel that we give female astronauts so the hair doesn't fly into their face that allows it to keep pretty well in space and stay. I've used said products. Works great.
Okay.
So, but you know, that is a real thing where like, I mean, because like, I think of it when I see
people floating in space. It will be in this universe.
What was that?
It will be. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those, I watched, her hair's not floating all around. I'm like, yeah, technically I know why they didn't do it because, you know, just to try to CGI hair flying around, whatever, would be a pain in the butt. But to be honest with you, who's to say they don't have, you know, she doesn't use a gel that keeps her hair. I'm like, okay, there's a gel. It's not even a stretch of the imagination. Imagine you could have a gel or whatever that does that. And it makes sense. Like, oh, let's do this also to keep your hair from just little stray hair follicles, you know, from flying around.
Right.
I guess that's the thing is like in my mind's eye, if I think of like shots of people floating in space, like female astronauts floating in space, like I don't think of them all looking like troll dolls. Like their hairs are kind of, their hair is in place. So yeah. I guess that never even rang hollow to me. Mysteries of Gravity. I'm back, Andrew. Nearly all satellites orbit Earth west to east, yet all satellite debris portrayed orbits east to west.
Ready for my answer?
Yeah.
Go.
Nearly all, not all.
All right.
Oh, really?
It's a choice. You know, there's a reason practically why you have them do that, because when you go launch things in which direction you want to go, that's fine. But you do have satellites that go the other direction. And this could be a chain of satellites that goes the opposite direction, which we'll address in a moment. So, you know, it's not a scientific inaccuracy. It's a thing like, well, most of them do this. Well, the answer is most. Some do. So it's not a physics problem. It's not
the question would be, what are there enough in this, again, fake universe, for them to create the chain of debris that is the antagonist in the movie.
Sure.
Right.
Mysteries of Gravity. Man, he was really pushing this. I'll tell you what. Satellite communications were disrupted at 230 miles up, but communication satellites orbit 100 times higher.
All right. This is one I think is kind of really fascinating because many communication satellites are, we use a lot of geostationary satellites, which are further up. And if you disrupt those, have very different dynamics because they're actually staying in position over the Earth, okay? And theoretically, it would be a totally different way if those got disrupted or whatever. But that's aside the point, because once he said, I'm like, wait, are you talking about geostationary satellites? Because then you wouldn't have the same debris scenario here that you're talking about there, as I understand it. But more importantly, he says communication satellites are this. All of them? Or what? And you don't. You take the Iridium network, which is in low Earth orbit, which is, these are satellites. It's a satellite constellations are in low Earth orbit, and you have far more of those than you would have a communication satellite. Instead of having, you know, a dozen or so that are in high orbit, you would have a bunch of them that are in a low Earth orbit. So you do get, Iridium is a big satellite network. I forget, like it's like 230 or satellite. I forget that, like 66. I forget the total number of satellites in the Iridium network. That's low Earth orbit. So you have communication satellites in low Earth orbit. So his tweet was scientifically inaccurate.
Oh, snap. Mysteries of Neil deGrasse Tyson's Gravity Rant.
I'm just saying.
How is it that the host of Cosmos cannot know about?
That got me the most, though, was just that, was because it stated not as a sum. It was, and again, the brevity of Twitter, but, you know, Iridium is a big communications network.
Here's the coup de grace.
And by the way, the most popular, the most retweeted of the epic rant
Mysteries of Gravity. Why we enjoy a sci-fi film set in make-believe space more than we enjoy actual people set in real space.
God damn. Man, I just, there are times in my life I could wish I could cause life to have a smash cut where it's like the moment you read that, it just cuts to the opening of Star Wars and it's just blasting, blowing stuff up, robots and all this stuff. And then smash cut to the dead silence of NASA raw footage on the ISS of people poking at bees in space.
How do we know that that is true? I don't think anybody went to Gravity hated space. I don't think anybody hated went to Gravity, you know, I hate this main exploration of space, but I'm going to go sit through a 2-hour movie all about what can go wrong.
Right.
You know, it gives us something to love about space. This is a movie about space that doesn't involve aliens. It's an extremely realistic, you know, depiction with some license, but as we've gone through, no scientific inaccuracies that you know, it seem, you know, to our minds. But again, you know, we're a couple apes here. Chimps. And to go like, why do people enjoy it more? I didn't know it was a contest. I didn't know that every time we liked a bit of fantasy, that meant we reject reality. And that's what gets me the most. That's what, like, I was, you know, as a skeptic, when I'd hear, you know, back in the day when X-Files was out, like, oh, we know that X-Files is horrible because, you know,
great,
people think it's
more
real.
Pro crazy talk.
Ah, I know. You can love these things. I love Harry Potter. I don't believe it's real.
Right, right.
You know, why that people love this and not, how do you know? Did you stand outside and say, did you like this or real people in space?
So, okay, this last.
Well, and it's also like, haven't we gotten to the point where it's like, hey, by dreaming about space exploration that we want to do it, by fulfilling the ideas that we have, the fantasies of tomorrow, that we want to achieve them. It makes us, it gives us a blueprint, if ever so sketchy, that we can make our reality like this fantasy.
We think about every movie about going to Mars that sort of this sucked, like all of them. It always involves, and we find the Mars civilization, and we find this. We've got a space movie, one of the few space movies ever that's, you know, not based on a real event like Apollo 13, that is about human problems, human situations, human challenges, things that we can understand. It was survival. It put into the space. You watch that and you didn't hate space. You didn't hate the idea of being an astronaut. It seems scary, but you appreciate it. Oh my God. You know, again, like, well, she wasn't wearing diapers. Who cares? You go, holy crap. This is a crazy, dangerous environment. Yet people go there for a reason. And so,
yeah, agreed.
Here's all I know. I don't know about all this science talk. I don't know about all this space talk. Here's what I do know, being an attention whore. And that, my friends, is grade A playing to the cheap seats.
Well, all right, here's the last one.
Stand up and say, like...
Take it away, Mr. deGrasse Tyson. Wrap it all up.
Because tweets hardly ever convey opinion, mostly perspectives on the world. But if you must know, I enjoyed Gravity very much.
All right, now, is he saying when he says this, like, no, my tweets aren't opinions, they're facts, and everything I said is facts. Like, is that what he was saying there?
I don't know.
I mean, listen, the one before,
it's just...
Timestamp is 5 hours after the end of his other stuff, like once the backlash had snuck
4 minutes before midnight.
Yeah.
3 minutes before.
It's just one of those things where when, you know, like we... You know, on NSFW, you know, the R.L. Stine character has kind of become a thing. And it's like the kind of hallmark is like, are there any Goosebumps fans in the house? He's like, you know, if somebody is listening to R.L. Stine, there's going to be people, the one thing that you know him for, like, that's going to be the thing. It's just, it's cheap heat. It's just one of those things where it's like, there's an element that will always be, why do we care more about this than science? Right. You know, and that is a large narrative of people who follow Neil deGrasse Tyson and just kind of want any excuse to pound that table and say, yes, science, I'm for science and you're not. And this is why. And it's annoying and it's cheap. And that's exactly what that last or the what the real.
We lost you there.
Global satellite disruption.
Why do we care about? Yeah, it's just, you know, because there is no capacity. There is no limit of love in our hearts for things. And in fact, you can make a credible argument to say that the love of Star Trek and Star Wars and Gravity and Aliens and all of these fantastic science fiction, I mean, even Avatar, you know, like a movie that wants to take seriously, at least in its own universe, what this world is and why it exists and why these creatures behave in a certain way, you know, that explores, that deepens our love for science.
We're guys will drive 200 miles to go watch a rocket launch that doesn't take place and love it.
Yeah, man. Look, all of that comes from the same place, and it's not a matter of one thing screwing up the other. And I don't know, you know, and of course, all of this is to say, you know, we certainly appreciate everything Neil deGrasse Tyson's done for the popularization of good science. And I'm super excited about Cosmos and so on. You know, what a bummer that so many people jumped on the bandwagon of a movie that went so far out of its way to get so much right and to tell an authentic story. And then, you know, as if it suffered from the uncanny valley. Like, it was so close to perfect that people felt the need to just drill in on all these tiny things. That bummed me out.
Well, there are some people who that's just their thing. Their thing is just, you know, like, well, this movie didn't have this thing. And, you know, let me write a whole talk about it.
Right.
And that's fine, man. I mean, like, there are people, I can understand, to be honest, I understand that more as a form of entertainment. If you are just playing to that audience that wants to say, I didn't like that movie, or like, oh, let me laugh at this movie that I didn't like because it got scientific things wrong.
Right.
You know, like, I can understand that, I guess, as a performance art, but I'm not going to jump up and say, well, finally somebody said it, you know?
Touche.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Go see Gravity if you haven't seen it. It's coming back out in IMAX 3D. I saw it in 3D, but not IMAX 3D, so I look forward to it. I had to wear there's a brand of 3D I don't like because the goggles are too small.
Mm-hmm.
But I even sat through it just to see the movie because I didn't want to miss the chance to see it in the theater. But I'll go back and see it in IMAX 3D.
Right on.
No, there you have it. It's been educational.
Well, I mean, it's been that, but it's also other things, right?
Yeah.
Informative.
Certainly that. We learned a lot from the host of Cosmos, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
If you were to say the tone of it, though.
It's been long?
No, not even that long. So shorter than most episodes.
It's been odd.
I mean, it's odd. It's odd that we've been on a good schedule, but I don't know that that's how I describe quintessentially the nature.
This is the filler when he brings up the source.
One of my favorite directors. Master of Commander, Far Side of the World, really quite well done. He's part of that whole Australian Renaissance or Australian sort of, you know, film.
Wait, this is who?
Peter Weir.
Weir.
Weir. Yeah.
You know, like, it's been Weir. Yeah.
No.
There's a river by the Weir way. It's Johnny Weir, the figure skater, too.
You had to bring the D. Bring the D.
Yeah, dude, we want the D.
We need the D.